This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top of the page, Teleflex charts major Morrisville expansion. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Morrisville. Medical device maker Teleflex is moving forward with plans to consolidate and expand its operations in the Triangle with a new five-story office building at Perimeter Park in Morrisville. Teleflex, an Indianapolis-based Duke Realty Corporation, the owner and developer of Perimeter Park, are expected to make a joint announcement in the coming days about their agreement to begin construction of a 204,000-square-foot building called Perimeter 3. Teleflex will lease about 150,000 square feet in the new building, with options to expand in the future, according to real estate sources familiar with the deal. The deal will allow Teleflex to merge its 500-plus employees in two buildings in the region and still have room to grow. Neither representatives of Teleflex nor Duke Realty returned calls for comment. Teleflex owns a 147,000-square-foot facility on Weck Drive in RTP, and it leases about 60,000 square feet at the Triangle Business Center 7 building on Stirrup Creek in Durham. Its lease at TBC, however, expires next spring, says Mike Green with BPG Management in Raleigh, the company that owns the TBC building. And Teleflex representatives in the past have said they want to sell the Weck Drive building. They've been too quiet, and quiet is not good, says Green, who has been trying to work out a renewal lease deal with Teleflex at TBC. I'm not sure what they're going to do, he says. Shannon Campbell, a planner with the Morrisville Planning Department, says Duke Realty filed a site plan in late July for a second 204,000-square-foot office building in its newest phase of Perimeter Park. The site plan, she says, will probably need to go through at least one more round of revisions with the town's planning staff. The project, however, will not need town council approval since it is part of a previously approved planned unit development. The site plan for its sister building, Perimeter 2, was approved in May, and the building is already 91% pre-leased to corporate tenants that include SciQuest, Fujifilm Medical Systems, Compliance Implementation Services, and MaxPoint Interactive. Teleflex has been in a transformation mode the last couple of years. Since Benson E. Smith takes over as chairman, president, and CEO of the Limerick, Pennsylvania-based company in 2011. In that time frame, Teleflex has sold off all of its remaining non-medical businesses in the automotive, aerospace, and industrial markets in an effort to become a pure-play medical company. While Teleflex did shut down in early 2013, its 152,000-square-foot warehouse in Durham after moving distributions out of state, the Teleflex Medical Division remains headquartered in RTP. It currently has 21 job positions listed in Durham and RTP on its career website. The company also has a manufacturing plant in Asheboro. Raymond James analyst Lawrence Kusch writes in a recent report where he upgraded Teleflex's target stock price to $92 a share, that even though Teleflex's profit margins have been flat the last couple of years. We believe now management has the appropriate investments to drive increased profitability, which should become more visible in the coming quarters. Teleflex's share price closed at $82 on September 18th. And now we move down the page to the cover story in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal. And the headline on this one is Healthcare Handoff: Why Firms Will Opt for Healthcare Exchanges Instead of Providing Company Health Benefits. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge. Dave Benavides served 38 years with Big Blue, and he would do it all again. I'm really thankful for what IBM has provided me over the years, he says. Benavides worked in Research Triangle Park as an executive in the public affairs organization for IBM. 8 years ago, he left the corporate life to enjoy his retirement. His days since have been active, filled with gardening and grandchildren. But a few weeks ago, he received a letter that sucked him back into corporate drama, at least for a little while. Benavides was among the estimated 110,000 IBM Medicare-eligible retirees who received a note saying that their health care coverage would shift from an IBM plan to a private health exchange. September 18, Duke Energy retirees received a similar memo. The utility plans to switch retirees off its company plan into the individual plan market through United Healthcare. Duke says the individual plans will cost less and cover more than Medicare supplement plans Duke currently offers. And experts are saying they won't be the last retirees to get that kind of memo. As the looming Affordable Care Act comes to full fruition, more employers may take a serious look at private health exchanges, and not just for retirees. Current employees could find a memo waiting in their inboxes as well. On September 18, Walgreens Company announced a plan to make payments to eligible employees to enable them to purchase individual insurance coverage starting in 2014. Skip Woody, managing partner of Durham benefit consultant Hill Chesson & Woody, says a health exchange can be a good option for companies fearing health care increases. The control factor for the employer is that each year, that employer can decide, do we add more money for each employee, he says. They are less tied to how much health care costs go up and more tied to how much they are willing to contribute. And the exchange can have a masking effect to employees. It masks a little bit of what's actually happening with employer contributions and employee cost sharing because you went from two options to now 10, he says. It might be hard for the average Joe employee to see the change. Shift far from over. Richard Doherty, who spent more than 38 years with Big Blue, 22 as vice president and general manager of the research facility in RTP, says he wasn't surprised to see the memo, though he didn't have insider information. I don't have that these days, he says. He says he's a little bit surprised that it didn't happen sooner. There's a trend, a shift to individual responsibility, he says, adding that he's reserving judgment until he knows exactly how the plan will affect him. The devil is in the details. Until you see what the exact policy is you want is and how much IBM will pay and how much you will pay, you can't really know. There were signs that change was coming. In the 90s, IBM capped its contributions, meaning that as healthcare costs increased, the patients would be paying more, not IBM. You have to be adaptable, Benavides says. Don't always assume the negative. I'm not. But he's having to educate himself as to his new options. If I'm an 85-year-old retiree, my reaction would be, in my 85 years, I've never had to shop for health insurance, and I don't want to start now, says Paul Fronston, director of the Health Research and Education Program at the Employee Benefit Research Institute in Washington, D.C. While retirees will still have health coverage with an exchange, the responsibility falls on the individuals and not IBM. In some ways, it benefits retirees to have options, he points out. If you've got 110,000 people in a room and said, would you pick this plan? My bet is 110,000 retirees wouldn't raise their hands, he says. IBM isn't the first one to do this. And he's right. Extend Health, the private health exchange that got IBM's business this time around, has about 300 employers as clients, including DuPont, which has about 870 employees in North Carolina. Spokesperson Tara Condon Tuller says DuPont made the change to provide its retirees with more choices, personal flexibility, cost savings, and also to simplify the administrative process. Time Warner Incorporated and General Motors have made similar moves. But with new choices, there's an obvious risk, says John Grosso, senior vice president at consultant firm Aon Hewitt. There's much more responsibility on the retiree to find a place that's right for them to make the dollars last as long as they can, he says. The individual retiree is really on the hook for figuring all that out. Hunt for bottom line. The bigger benefit can fall to the companies, which may save in premium payouts. And while IBM's premiums are capped, it can take advantage of administrative savings, says Grosso says. Their administrative costs are going to be coming down because they are no longer supporting a group program, he says. Other companies that have yet to cap their subsidies could save even more. Grosso says to expect other companies to figure that out and look at their own options. Most companies that do this typically take some savings in premium subsidy, he reiterates. What's happening here is a new strategy that has been facilitated by federal health care reform. And he's not just talking about the Affordable Care Act. Specifically, improvements have been made to programs that are concurrent to Medicare, such as the Medicare Prescription Drug Program and Medicare Advantage, And those changes happened during the Bush administration and aren't part of Obamacare. The significance of IBM making the announcement shouldn't be taken lightly, says David Williams, president of the Massachusetts-based Health Business Group. People follow suit with IBM, and IBM generally has quite generous benefits compared to many companies. Williams notes, I do think this move for IBM will clear the way for a lot of the larger, more conservative companies to make more use of the insurance exchanges for retirees, not just Medicare retirees, but all retirees, and potentially for all active employees as well. But changing a retiree plan might be easier than shifting plans for active employees, says Womble Carlyle Sandridge and Rice LLP attorney Bill Whitehurst. Retirees, I think, are a particularly attractive group for exchanges because they're no longer with you, he says. You don't have the same immediacy in terms of employer satisfaction in your program, and cost containment, frankly, is different for that group because of their age. Until the Affordable Care Act comes to fruition, health plans are a voluntary benefit employers can modify, even for active employees. Retirees, says Mary Turk Mina, Charlotte-based partner at K&L Gates LLP, are the easiest population to start with because an employer doesn't have to face them every day. But the switch could happen in any stage of an employee's career. Health plans have always been a voluntary offering of employers, Turk Mina reminds. This applies to retirees. It applies to active employees. No company under the law before 2014 has any obligation to provide health coverage to employees. They did it because of the competitive pressure. 300 and counting. Bryce Williams, managing director of Exchange Solutions for Towers Watson & Company and founder of Extend Health, is familiar with the challenges employers face. In addition to the Medicare-eligible retiree plan exchange, his company has already rolled out, for IBM and others, Extend has two other programs in its pipeline, one for earlier retirees and another for active employees. The earlier retiree program is also intended for part-time and seasonal workers and is being built right now. Here you have populations of people whose plans and costs of coverage have gone up dramatically, he says. Is there a better way to connect them to value? He thinks so, and of his estimated 300 clients, including IBM, he says 60% could find real value in switching its active employees to a private exchange. That plan, he says, already has 3 clients and more than 50,000 participants, though he won't yet be specific about which companies are on board. We'll be announcing those names in a couple of weeks, he says. And we also have a shorter related story as part of the cover story, also written by Lauren Onsorge. The headline is, A Health Exchange Right for Your Company. So how do you tell if a health exchange is right for your company? John Grosso, Senior Vice President at consultant firm Aon Hewitt, says companies have to take the first step of doing a full financial analysis to fully understand the savings opportunities. They're also going to want to take a look at the plans in the individual markets and understand the number and types of plans available in every location of retirees to make sure retirees have a place to go to get coverage, he says. And they need to review their legacy retiree benefit commitments and understand the extent to which they have an ability and a willingness to make this kind of change. But the most important consideration may be picking the exchange itself, he says. Specifically, the company might want to look at demographics. Older retirees will need more support during the process. There are a number of players out there, each with a different customer service model, he says. The biggest challenge in moving forward? Publicity. Healthcare is an emotional issue, so when you move from a group-based approach to an individualized strategy, retirees are going to think it's a bad thing, he says. Dealing with public relations implications is going to be very important. That's where the health exchange partner can come in, educating retirees on their options and on what the switch means in terms of their care. Extend Health, for example, has created a portal for the adult children of its client employees so that they can help their parents make informed choices. It's part of our concierge service to IBM retirees, founder Bryce Williams says, pointing to IBM's decision to shift its Medicare-eligible retirees to Extend's exchange. Mary Turk Mina, a Charlotte-based partner at K&L Gates LLP, says to proceed with caution. From the employee's standpoint, these are new kind of animals, so there is, in many cases, unclear law about exactly what kind of entity the exchanges are, she says. They are moving from something they understand to something that's new. And she echoes that it will be a real communications challenge. It's going to fall largely on the employer, she says. And we have another short section also related to the cover story that's headlined, Misconceptions About IBM's Plan. As retirees deal with the reality of health exchanges and the world waits to see if changes will trickle down to active employees, misinformation can dominate the facts, says Bryce Williams, founder of Extend Health and managing director for Towers Watson Exchange Solutions. He points out five basic fallacies regarding the impact of a private exchange on IBM's Medicare-eligible retirees. Myth 1. Myth number 1 is that this is somehow connected to Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act, and the answer is no. He says that the foundation for the exchange actually began a decade ago with Medicare reforms passed during the Bush administration. Myth 2. People have said, oh, this is shifting a burden from employers to taxpayers. That's dead wrong. He points to the elimination of a 28% employer tax break for certain Medicare programs, noting, this is actually better for taxpayers because big corporations are no longer receiving a big 28% tax break. Myth 3. That somehow retirees are worse off in this program, he says, pointing to a report by IBM showing that its prior retiree program was going to triple in cost between now and 2020. So our program is not going to be anywhere near that. Myths 4 and 5. That somehow this is a way of companies getting out of having to provide health care coverage to retirees, he says. Since we've built this company, all of our clients, all 300 clients, not one of them has turned off a single dollar to a single retiree. That somehow retirees are dissatisfied with this program, and that's dead wrong. And now we turn to biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. Chamber Chair's role model, Dad. When Richard Urquhart took the helm as chair of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors at last week's annual meeting, he was continuing a long family tradition. His father, also Richard, had assumed the chamber's chairmanship in 1977. In his remarks about the issues facing today's chamber, Urquhart noted that in his father's day, the agenda included jobs, infrastructure, school budgets, and differences that arose between the school board and county commissioners. Imagine that, Urquhart quipped. Raleigh may have changed dramatically in the past four decades, but the issues are very much the same. Urquhart, who is chief operating officer at Investors Management Corporation, also shared with attendees that his father enjoyed reminding him of the wisdom that comes with age. Remember, son, I taught you everything you know, but not everything I know. Cell phones okay in these waiting rooms. A Raleigh-based software company and a Cary doctor's office have teamed up to make sure you can keep your medical information in your pocket. Raleigh's EchoBase is partnering with Mann Ear, Nose, and Throat. Through the deal, Mann's patients will be able to carry their medical histories on their iOS mobile devices at all times, without having to rely on a constant Wi-Fi connection. This means that instead of relying on those forms you fill out in the waiting room, you can now just hand your doctor the data directly. According to Dr. Jared Spector, one of Mann's principal physicians, the software gets patients involved in their own care, which leads to better overall health. Lawyers in love with their football teams. Nelson, Mullins, Riley, and Scarborough, LLP's attorneys and staff, put aside all football rivalry trash talk recently to celebrate a preseason after-hours tailgate party on the plaza of its Park Lake Avenue office. Enjoying the festivities, and in there's a picture, where Jessica Adams, managing partner Noah Huffstedler, Debbie Sheets, Jessica Basic, and Joy Beek. It's probably safe to say trash talk will pick up again when the Tar Heels play the Wolfpack, as fans from both teams are well represented at the law firm. Study puts price on coal mining's impact. To meet current U.S. coal demand through surface mining, an area of the central Appalachians the size of Washington, D.C. would need to be mined every 81 days, about 68 square miles or 10 city blocks mined every hour. That's according to research done by Brian Lutz, who started the analysis 1 year ago at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment and is now an assistant professor of biogeochemistry at Kent State. The study was published in the peer-reviewed online journal PLOS-1, and Lutz says he thinks he's the first to put an environmental price tag on mountaintop removal of coal. While many studies have documented the impact of surface mining on local ecosystems, few have quantified the region-wide extent of the damage and provided metrics to weigh the environmental costs of mountaintop mining. The sea of liquidity is a nice place to land. Biz did not sense any bitterness in Raleigh entrepreneur Pete Lofton's voice when talking to him about the auction of the Versace mansion that went for $41.5 million to the Nakash family of Jordache Jeans fame. "I am a changed man," Lofton contends. "I am back to thinking about starting and running companies." The auction of the Versace mansion was court-sanctioned after Lofton did a voluntary bankruptcy filing in order to prevent the largest creditor from putting the mansion in receivership. Well, guess what? It was the largest creditor that won the bid on September 17. The Nakash family indirectly owns the entity that holds the $26 million note. So one would think even after paying off the note and a laundry list of sundry expenses, Lofton should pocket a few million bucks. Biz now hopes he puts that money to good use. Contributing to Biz were staffers Lauren Onsorge and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to the full-length stories in the Triangle Business Journal. This next article, written by Jason DeBrun, has the headline, "Carmanos Rift Smoldered for a Decade, Sun Says." It can be hard to work under a boss with a strong personality, especially so if that boss is your father. That likely played a factor in the decade of tension that culminated in Carolina Hurricanes owner Peter Carmanos Jr. firing his son Jason Carmanos earlier this month. "It was a personal disagreement between my dad and I that led to me being fired by him," Jason Carmanos says, just days after the team announced he had been relieved of his duties. "The personal situation between my dad and I has been deteriorating for the past 10 years, so the decision was, unfortunately, not new or sudden," he added. "Obviously, this is very difficult on both a personal and professional level, to say the least. I'm still very disappointed by what happened," he says. "It is what it is." Jason Carmanos did not share details about the disagreement, and his father says that it was a family matter in a release statement. Jason Carmanos had been with the team for 15 years, most recently as executive vice president and assistant general manager. Team president and minority owner Jim Rutherford called Jason Carmanos a very good worker, but did not elaborate on any father-son disagreement. He says Jason would, of course, be invited to games, though not be involved with the team directly. Jason Carmanos says he isn't sure what he will do next. He has four daughters who are all born here, and his family has grown roots in the Triangle for 15 years. "It's been a little difficult to wrap my brain around the possibility of working for another team, if that opportunity was even available," he says. It's unlikely he would return to the Hurricanes. He left the organization once, but that was his decision and only for a short time. "I would say that this one has much more finality to it," Jason Carmanos says. "The prior time I left on my own for various reasons, and this time I was fired. There's a fairly big difference there." Calls to Pete Carmanos were not returned. The decision sent shockwaves throughout much of the organization. Abel Zalkberg, co-founder of the office furniture distributor OFM Incorporated, bought a minority stake in the Hurricanes in 2011. "This came as much of a surprise to me as anyone else," he says. "I have no idea what the family dynamics were." He doubts it will hurt the team. "The players, I don't think, will feel the effect," he says. Family Business Dilemma. Jim Lee, an expert on family business and professor at UNC Chapel Hill, says he has seen disagreements like this many times. "Sometimes the dynamics of the kitchen table get carried over into the conference table," he says. "It's exactly what has been going on since the kid was old enough to walk and talk and run away when his father says, 'Come here.'" Lee adds, in big companies, especially high-profile sports teams, the media coverage is heavier, so more attention is drawn to the split. In 2009, the sons of Carolina Panthers owner Jerry Richardson resigned unexpectedly on the same day. At one point, the two had been expected to take over the team. Looking at things from a different angle, Lee surmises that in some cases, the younger generation is really interested in the lifestyle and not all that interested in what makes the lifestyle possible. By that, he means that children who grow up in a wealthy environment don't always understand what it took to get to that position or what it takes to maintain that lifestyle. Lee acknowledged he has no knowledge of the specific dynamics of the Karmanos relationship. Pete Karmanos founded CompuWare in 1973 with two partners who pooled their tax return money to start the company. It has since grown to 4,500 employees and had revenue of $1 billion in 2011. Karmanos retired as CompuWare board chairman earlier this year. Enter Ron Francis. Looking forward to the season, the team announced that Hurricane legend Ron Francis would take over some of Jason Karmanos' duties. Francis was already vice president of hockey operations. "He's been working with me on everything for the past couple of years," Rutherford says of Francis. "He's a very smart person and a smart hockey person." Asked about any weaknesses to overcome, Rutherford paused. "I guess everybody has weaknesses, but I don't think there are any that he really has to overcome," he says. Although Francis will have minor responsibilities on the business side, Rutherford says most of his duties will be in player evaluation and development, including salaries, contracts, and trade talks. Rutherford says he does not expect to bring on anyone new in the near term. And now we turn to the A Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we'll read Todd Cohen's column, which has the headline, "Easter Seals UCP Mall Strategy to Offset Loss of Food Lion Promo." Since 1991, Easter Seals UCP has raised more than $36 million through Shop and Care, a cause marketing program it created and operated in partnership with Food Lion. This year, the effort generated $3.8 million for Easter Seals affiliates in 10 states, including over $2 million for Easter Seals UCP. That total represents 40% of the $5 million the nonprofit generates each year through private contributions to support its $86 million annual budget. But after this year's campaign, which was held in February in Food Lion stores in 10 southeastern and mid-Atlantic states, Easter Seals UCP learned Food Lion was dropping out of the partnership as part of a new corporate giving strategy to focus on needs involving food and food insecurity. While Food Lion will permit individual stores to participate in the Shop and Care campaign in 2014, Easter Seals UCP is working to relaunch its cause marketing strategy to try to offset the loss of its single biggest source of philanthropic support. Easter Seals UCP, which is headquartered in Raleigh, employs 3,000 people and delivers more than 3.3 million hours of support to more than 20,000 individuals and their families managing disabilities and mental health challenges throughout North Carolina and most of Virginia. The nonprofit generates most of its funds through contracts and services, largely through Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements. Easter Seals UCP has been working for more than a year to re-engineer its business model to develop strategic partnerships that focus on better connecting the clients and communities it serves to the most helpful solutions to their needs, says Jeff Smith, Chief Communications Officer at Easter Seals UCP. People living with disabilities and mental health challenges represent a big part of the population and face a broad range of needs, such as access to affordable housing, health care, and jobs, he says. For example, one in every four people has a mental illness that can be diagnosed, and nearly 70% of youth in trouble suffer from a mental health disorder. And nearly 80% of adults with disabilities are unemployed, with one in every four individuals with disabilities living in poverty. Food Lion has made a tremendous impact on what we've done over the years, Smith says. And he says he hopes shoppers at individual Food Lion stores that opt to run Shop and Care campaigns in 2014 will continue to support the effort. Meanwhile, he says Easter Seals UCP is looking for new strategies to build on its Shop and Care program that will allow retailers, their customers and vendors, and possibly other nonprofits to work together to address critical community issues. Easter Seals, for example, is considering franchising or leasing the Shop and Care cause marketing program to other businesses or community partners tying the Shop and Care brand to causes such as poverty or affordable housing rather than to individual organizations, Smith says. We want to continue to connect with other retailers and community partners, he says, in creative ways that would provide solutions to people with disabilities. And in nonprofit news, Wake County Smart Start received a three-year grant of $295,496 from the John Rex Endowment to create a coordinated system ensuring that home visiting services are easily accessible and better utilized by the community. The new program is called Wake Connections, Partnerships to Support Young Children at Home. Funding will be used to coordinate home visiting programs in the county that serve children birth to 5 years. Additionally, the initiative will provide support for parents and other agencies wishing to make referrals or seeking guidance. A goal of the program is to simplify access to services for families of young children in Wake County. Duke Children's Hospital and Health Center received a $250,000 grant for pediatric cancer research from Hyundai Hope on Wheels. Pediatric cancer is the leading disease-related cause of death among children under the age of 15, affecting nearly 15,000 new kids each year. Yet, only 3% of federal funding for cancer research is allocated to all pediatric cancers combined. This year, Hope on Wheels will surpass $72 million in funding research focused on pediatric cancers since its inception. Since 2005, Duke Children's Hospital and Health Center has received more than $1.6 million from Hope on Wheels. And in the People on the Move section, Shannon Tucker, Brenda Berg, and Amanda Cheney were appointed as event co-chairs for Band Together NC, a Triangle-based organization that works to use live music as a platform for social change. The Public School Forum of North Carolina and the North Carolina Center for After-School Programs selected Del Ruff as director and Lauren Hales as program officer. The forum works to improve North Carolina's public education system. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. And first we come to the page for Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. And her first story has the headline, Fitch Built a Niche with Farrington. Farrington founder R.B. Fitch turns 80 years old this year, which also marks 40 years since he started planning for his own little oasis, Farrington Village, on a 640-acre farm in rural Chatham County, 8 miles south of Chapel Hill in Carrboro. Farrington Village has grown to become one of the top retirement destinations in the South, even though there's no age restriction to live or own a home there, and his Farrington House Inn and Farrington House Restaurant are recognized as among the finest establishments in the world by both Forbes Travel Guide and AAA. I talked with R.B. Fitch about his restaurant's new 5-star rating from Forbes, the construction activity we've been seeing around Farrington Village, and why he stays so involved in the day-to-day operations at Farrington. About the ratings. Forbes Travel Guide recently released a new list of hotel and restaurant properties around the world that have earned its coveted 5-star ranking for quality and service. And included on that list for the first time was the Farrington House Restaurant in Pittsburgh. We've had the 5-star for the inn for about 10 years, and we've been a AAA 5-diamond for a long time as well. And we had a 4-star for the restaurant for a long time, but the 5th-star looked elusive. About this competition? For nearly 20 years, the 33-room Farrington House Inn was the only hotel in the Triangle with a AAA 5-diamond rating. And in 2007, the wealthy Goodnight family in Cary opened the 150-room Umstead Hotel and Spa, which has since joined Farrington at the top of the AAA 5-diamond and Forbes Travel Guide 5-star rating lists. I think it's a good thing, Fitch says, explaining that the two properties generally target two different audiences. That's a hotel, and we're more of an inn. We try to sell charm and relaxation. They target a little bit different market. I think it's a plus-plus for our market. About the housing development. Since construction began at Farrington Village in the late 1970s, about 1,250 homes have been constructed, and he says there's still room to build about 300 more units in future years. While Farrington has families of all ages living there, a higher percentage of its residents are active retirees or empty nesters. We started noticing in the last 5 years we had more single people moving in, mainly ladies who have been professionals, maybe gone through a divorce, and want a change of place. So we did a get-together with a group of ladies to find out what it is they want in a home and tweaked our designs for what they really like. It's really dumb to build something people don't like. Construction has begun on the first 12 townhouse cottages in Farrington's new Rutherford Close neighborhood, which will offer units ranging from 1,800 to 2,100 square feet, with prices starting at $375,000. About his years at Farrington. I was 40 years old when we got started, and now I'm 80, so I got old somewhere along the way. As long as you're having fun, though, better just keep on doing it. The next reporter page is that of Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. His first article is headlined, More UNC Faculty Choosing Gradual Retirement. Tenure profs opt for part-time exit strategy while university benefits from senior expertise. More UNC professors are again entering phased retirement. The University of North Carolina system implemented its phased retirement program in 1998 as a way to allow tenured faculty members to work part-time. In the years immediately following the banking crisis, fewer faculty members entered the program. In 2012, that figure began to creep upward again, coming closer to historical figures from the mid-2000s. The phased retirement program is an important tool for retaining the talents and contributions of faculty members after their retirement, according to a report prepared for the UNC Board of Governors, the group of appointed members who oversee the entire UNC system. Although many retiring faculty members will be replaced by new hires, UNC institutions still benefit from the accumulated experience and expertise of their retiring faculty members, an outcome of that the phased retirement program is specifically designed to accomplish. To qualify, a professor must have earned tenure and have at least 5 years of service at an institution. By entering the program, the professor gives up tenure and works half-time at half pay. And the next article is headlined, General Assembly's Oversight of Capital Improvements Depends on Project Size. The state's university leaders divided up $60 million that was allocated from the General Assembly for general repairs and renovations. For major capital projects, universities make a request, which must then be approved by the UNC Board of Governors, the group of appointed members which oversees the university system statewide. The board then requests money from the state. For smaller repair and renovation projects, however, the state allocates money to the Board of Governors, which then divides it up among the universities. This year, the General Assembly appropriated $150 million for repairs and renovations statewide. Per the allocation model, the universities receive 40% or $60 million this year. In the past 10 years, the universities have spent a combined $2 billion in minor repairs and renovations. And a final article on Jason DeBrun's page is headlined, Duke Expands Its Reach to China. Duke University received approval to open Duke Kunshan University, the joint venture in China that will confer Duke degrees. This is a major milestone for Duke and one that university leaders have been working toward since at least 2010. It has not been without controversy, however, as some faculty raised questions about losing money and academic freedoms. President Richard Broadhead has long said the university would lose money in the short term, and in April revised some of the financial estimates of how much Duke would have to subsidize DKU in the near term. And the new figures are spread out over 8 years, while the first estimates made in February 2012 were over 7 years. The subsidy will be shared by Duke and Wuhan University, Duke's partner in the joint venture. And now, in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the reporter page for Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. And her main article is a question and answer headlined, New iPhone Bears His Fingerprint. Before F. Scott Moody became a regular at entrepreneurship events in the Triangle, he was the CEO and founder of Melbourne, Florida-based Authentech, a company he sold to Apple in 2012 for $356 million. Authentech developed fingerprint security technology, science Apple is using in its latest phones. We caught up with Moody the day of the iPhone announcement. How does it feel to have your technology in an iPhone? I'm just exceedingly excited. When did you find out? As soon as they announced it this afternoon, I was reading a live blog post. That's not something that Apple would keep me privy on, nor should they. Obviously, when we were acquired, I think everybody knew that at some point, it was very logical that we would be incorporated into some set of products. As the weeks went along, there were always rumors about Apple and iPhones. There were a lot of indicators where it looked like this was going to happen. There's a lot of concern about privacy from conspiracy theorists. What's your take on that in regards to Touch ID technology? Will there be a secret fingerprint database coming out of this? You know, I can't tell you exactly what they're going to do, but I did see as part of the Apple announcement that the fingerprint is only going to be stored in the phone. And that's the way I believe it should be done, that it will not be held in a database. I think they're going to do it right from what I saw. Is the technology utilized how you envisioned? We talked about a lot of things, security, e-commerce. Frankly, we were talking about those a number of years ago, and Apple is a very visionary company, so I'm assuming they'll do things beyond what we thought, so that's very exciting. So how do you get acquired by an Apple? I guess you don't. You do, but it's not a plan. We didn't set out to say, you know, we want to be acquired by this company. We wanted to have a great big company and be a part of everybody's lives. That's kind of what we wanted to do. I think if you have the right focus and you work exceedingly hard, the good things will happen. Moody, who calls the moving to the Triangle the best decision we've ever made, has since founded First Talent Ventures, aiming to connect venture capital to entrepreneurs in the Southeast. And on this page, we have a sneak peek headlined, Wingo Sees Opportunities in Global E-Commerce. For Scott Wingo, it's been more of a journey. It's been more than a journey. It has been an ongoing adventure. It's also an area that entrepreneurs can learn from. Wingo co-founded and serves as CEO of Channel Advisor, but that's not the beginning of his entrepreneurship ballad. Try Stingray Software in 1995. The software company, the first step on his adventure, was sold in 1998 to Rogue Wave Software. And it gave Wingo his first taste of number crunching as the company was bootstrapped. The company, then at $12 million in revenue, was growing, so why sell? We couldn't see a path to $100 million, he recalls. And while he stayed on board for a year, the entrepreneurial itch was triggered as he started to think about e-commerce. Wingo raised $3 million and started auctionrover.com in 1999. The online auction technology was a hot space, and within 6 months, he sold it to GoTo.com, which is now part of Yahoo. At the time, eBay was starting to emerge, mainly as a place to sell Beanie Babies, he jokes. But what if this thing that is for Beanie Babies becomes more of a mall, he started to ask. That's when he started building software again, not knowing that this time he'd create a long-term opportunity, and one that would eventually, in 2013, be a public company, Channel Advisor. And for Channel Advisor, the next step could be even more global growth. We have typically been pulled into international markets, Wingo explains, adding that the customers happen and then the office happens. But the global growth is going to keep Channel Advisor in the e-commerce game. After all, he notes, the United States will be 25% of e-commerce by 2017. In the long term, we need to look more like that, he says. And the spotlight article for this edition of the Triangle Business Journal is headlined, Regulators Drop 20% Down Requirements from Mortgage Proposal. Now, this article is written by Kent Hoover with a dateline of Washington, D.C. Lenders and affordable housing advocates won a victory when federal regulators walked away from a proposed rule that would encourage mortgage lenders to require a 20% down payment from home buyers. Requiring such a large down payment would make it harder for first-time home buyers and others without substantial savings to get a mortgage. Regulators today issued a revised risk retention proposal for lenders who securitize mortgages. Under the new proposal, qualified residential mortgages would not require a 20% down payment. This change is important because qualified residential mortgages are exempt from the Dodd-Frank Act's requirement that lenders retain some credit risk when they securitize their loan. Banking groups praised the revisions. David Stevens, president and CEO of the Mortgage Bankers Association, said the changes show how well the notice and comment process can work on proposed regulations. Regulators proposed a rule and received a unanimous reaction from diverse groups within housing and real estate finance that the proposal would have unduly constrained the availability of mortgage credit for many borrowers, he said. As a result, the regulators recognized the implications for consumers and the broad mortgage markets and decided to alter and then repropose a much better rule. The new direction regulators are taking is a very positive step, but the details will determine whether an average American family can purchase a home affordably, said Ethan Handelman, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy for the National Housing Conference. Bankers and housing advocates remain nervous, however, because regulators also asked for comment on an alternative rule that effectively would require a 30% down payment in order for home loans to be qualified residential mortgages. It's doubtful regulators would adopt that alternative, given the outcry over a 20% down payment, but nothing certain until a final rule is issued. Kent Hoover is TBJ's Washington Bureau Chief. And in another story, in this spotlight on banking and finance, is written by Adam O'Daniel with the Dateline of Charlotte. And the headline is, Credit Union Group Focusing on Tax Reform Consolidation. John Radabaugh's job just got a lot bigger. The president of the North Carolina Credit Union League will now lead the soon-to-be-merged credit union leagues in the two Carolinas. The trade groups announced the final merger approval this week. Charlotte Business Journal caught up with Radabaugh to discuss the changing credit union landscape. Following are edited excerpts. How did the merger come about? The CEO in South Carolina, Steve Fowler, announced his retirement, and so the board there started looking strategically at what to do, either hire a new person or collaborate or merge with us. Our two organizations have been doing a lot together for years, and we just decided that both of us are a good fit together. There have been other consolidations across the country. You get efficiency with a larger organization. We're getting larger credit unions and fewer credit unions. That has an adverse effect on our membership and income. This gives us a broader market for credit unions as members. Small banks are consolidating to gain size and scale. Do credit unions need to get bigger? I think we'll continue to see it. Small institutions have a harder time competing. It's hard to offer all the products and services people demand without scale. There will always be smaller institutions that have a great niche, but those are becoming fewer. When you look at the financial services industry, in my opinion, it seemed to be oversaturated for a while. It's a natural progression for the curve to come back down for banks and credit unions. It will eventually level back out. In the banking industry, they merge or are bought out because it's good for the stockholders. In the credit union space, we don't have stockholders, so we do mergers when it's good for the members, when we can serve the members better with more products and services. What's the top policy issue for credit unions right now? On the national level, it's tax reform. Credit unions are exempt from federal corporate income tax, and they pass those savings on. So we're being very proactive about educating our congressional legislators on the benefits of that exemption. It's good policy to have a nonprofit financial system in the United States. That's really our huge focus. Regulatory burden continues to take its toll, complying with a never-ending stream of regulation. We're making sure we have regulations that make sense, but our main focus has been the tax exemption. Credit unions have unsuccessfully lobbied Congress to lift the cap on business loans. Anything new on that front? Senator Mark Udall from Colorado has introduced the bill that has been introduced before. We still want to get that passed, but because of the tax reform conversation right now, that is our most important thing. And Adam O'Daniel covers banking, entrepreneurs, and technology for the Charlotte Business Journal, a sister publication. Now we'll turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal and read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee. And the headline is, Numbers Don't Lie. Writing about the economy in general terms is a total waste of time for the reader and the writer. At least that's what I believe. For example, if I went about writing about the economy and not explaining the terms and the trends, will that provide any intelligence for you as you go about managing your business and people? Probably not. So when I read this economic report with an 18-part formula about our local economy, it got my attention. Essentially, the report titled On Numbers and conducted by our parent company measures the relative vitality of 102 major markets with more than 500,000 residents. In the past year, the local economies of Raleigh MSA and Durham MSA have fallen markedly in the rankings when compared to the rankings at the same time last year. Raleigh has fallen from number 32 to number 81, while Durham has tumbled from 12th to 60th. A deeper look at the numbers shows why we're losing ground. Raleigh's five-year private sector job growth is an anemic 2.76%. For Austin, Texas, the top-ranked metro in the latest report, the number was 11.8%. What does that tell us? Our economic developers, city leaders, and county officials need to work harder to see why we are falling behind. There may be some structural issues we need to address. Weekly earnings per worker in the Raleigh MSA is $780. For Durham, it's $919. For Austin, Texas, it's $939. See the problem? When the jobless rate is high, too many people are chasing too few jobs. No reason for employers to pay more for talent. But while it may be a good thing in the short run for employers, healthy wages drive consumer behavior. Want an IKEA store in the Triangle? Work on getting those average wages up first. You get the point? Raleigh and Durham areas did not perform well in the home value index either. Home prices grew, but slowly. Raleigh's overall home value was up 2.4%, and Durham was up 1.46% in the past year. Compare that to the top 10 cities in the September index. Eight of the markets showed a one-year growth of 4.5% or more. Austin's was 7.65%. As a triangle, we have a lot going for us, but lawmakers, city, and state leaders should take a hard look at why some companies are leaving or going out of business, even as we bring in other companies and new jobs. Some might say it's because our industry base is changing. True, but that's also true with Austin, Provo, Utah, Dallas, and 50 other metro areas across the region. Everyone is changing around us. But what are we changing into? Numbers don't lie. And in our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the guest opinion in the Triangle Business Journal. And this opinion is from Michael Jacobs, professor of finance at the University of North Carolina's MBA School and CEO of Jacobs Capital. He served as director of corporate finance at the U.S. Treasury Department. And the headline on his guest opinion column is, after spending some time there, I'm convinced the China story is very real. Over the summer, most of the Western media coverage of China's economy was not rosy. Pundits speculated that the China bubble had burst, but if you look at the dramatic changes taking place under the new leadership, coupled with several attributes that escape economic models, the long-term outlook seems much more bullish. I wanted to see what is really going on, so I accepted an opportunity to teach business in Beijing for the summer. One of China's greatest economic advantages is its lack of gender discrimination. The one-child policy in China has amplified the desire of parents and grandparents to see their young women, in particular, succeed. Without as strong a cultural bias against the advancement of women that we see in other BRIC countries, China's entire population can participate in the economy. The lack of religious tensions that will permanently handicap most of the developing world is another one of China's greatest economic advantages. The resources diverted globally to containing religious tension and terrorism are less necessary in China. The new Chinese leadership is prodding the bureaucracy daily to foster a market economy. Transparency is growing. China's leaders embrace a mass urbanization. By 2030, 300 million people are expected to migrate from the countryside to cities. The government is sending a poignant message that macro stimulus will take a backseat to structural reforms in the private sector. This will make the economy more sustainable. Currently, 118 of the largest Chinese companies, which account for 43% of China's GDP, are state-owned. Another 145,000 companies are owned by local governments. The Chinese leaders admit that the influence of the government in business must be reduced for the economy to advance. State-dictated borrowing and deposit rates are being phased out as government leaders force the powerful establishment in the banking sector to adapt to market realities. Corruption is being vigorously rooted out. Over 2,200 government officials have been called out publicly or sent to prison for abusing expense accounts and other graft. The good old boy system is being dismantled, which may be lowering current consumption of luxury goods. But it is good for the long term. The leaders are listening to the people. A China National Nuclear Corporation project to build a fuel facility in Jiangmen was scrapped when a majority of local residents protested. On June 18, Shenzhen launched China's first pilot carbon trading program. Beijing just announced nearly $500 billion allocation to reduce pollution. Meanwhile, Shanghai received approval for a massive free trade zone. Intellectual property rights are starting to be taken more seriously. Last year, there were 83,850 lawsuits claiming infringements on patents, trademarks, and copyrights. And we'll stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal, but be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.